Hello, everybody, and welcome to our special bonus workshop with Thomas Hubel. We have our title is Radical Intimacy, the Practice of Enlightened Relating. And I'm really happy to have Thomas with me here today. Welcome, Thomas.
Hello, Terry. Thank you for having me with you.
Yeah. And so as we just begin to orient ourselves to this topic of intimacy, radical intimacy, I'm kind of struck by two things. One of them is the paradox of relationship. On the one hand, in mystical awakening, we kind of arrive at a place where this distinction between me and you begins to dissolve, and so the relating from one to another, kind of, which depends on, you know, you are not me, I am not you, you know, relating across that distinction may begin to break down. But most of us begin with this very hard boundaries around ourselves and a real division. And sometimes even a division in our relationship to ourselves. And it's almost like we have to come into a friendlier, connected quality of relationship with ourselves, even be available to relate to anyone else. So I wanted to invite you to consider those topics and maybe lead us in a process that can help us begin to get into this territory more deeply.
Yeah, first maybe some words, like some important factors, I think, in a deep relationship or in intimacy, is I think relationship is usually either dominated by where we feel good with each other. It's cut by where we don't feel good with each other. So, and it has to do with what I can accept in myself, like which parts of myself I can really dynamically inhabit in myself, and which parts of myself, my emotions, my thoughts, my whatever sensations in myself, intensities, intelligences that I cannot really inhabit in myself, so I will not be able to relate through them to other people. So that's where you said, if I am a stranger within my own self, I am not able to really create intimacy in the outside world, which is true. So there all the integration and the shadow work comes in. But then I think we also look, when we talk about intimacy, we usually what we say is we need time to get closer to one another. And I think it's a very interesting exploration. What actually is it that needs time? What is the very thing that needs a process? And the same thing is with a stranger. Like I recently look with people also, okay, what's really the process of a stranger? Because I think if you're asking for a cultural awakening, we need to see how many aspects of what we agree upon as culture are really true, and what might be just habits that we carry with us, but they are actually not true. But we do them because it's a habit. So when everybody believes creating a stranger is a truth, like when I see somebody for the first time, it's a stranger. And I will feel accordingly. So usually we are more checking, we are looking, we are exploring, we are looking if it's safe, we are looking who is the person, if I can relax. But what actually is already contracted, that needs to be relaxed. What it feels unsafe in order to feel safe. So what's the process of this playing field when we meet new people and suddenly we have friends? What's the process of a stranger and a friend? And I think it's an amazing exploration to see that there is a process happening, maybe within a few milliseconds in my brain, in my sensations, in my emotions, that says when there is a stranger, like I believe that also thousands of years of human evolution are still between us. you know, there are habits of how tribes needed to defend each, themselves from other tribes and from other countries. And so there is a history to it. It's not a stupid thing. And it's, but it's definitely something that I think we might create even an update that is surprising. Like that strangers might be erased. And how would the reality look like when there are no strangers? But I think we get there only like an intimacy, an immediate intimacy. And so the exploration of a stranger and intimacy is, I think, a fruitful thing to do if we want to create like a more awake culture, so to speak. Maybe that's the best how to call it.
I really appreciate that. And as I feel into it, just taking this on and exploring it for myself, I think when I meet someone for the first time, there are all kinds of bits of information that are coming into me about that person. And sometimes early on, the qualities that that person is expressing might seem to me to be creating a maybe they seem positively or negatively available. Like I'm gauging the degree to which this person is self-involved or available to make a connection, and I'm willing to open to meet that person, but I'm not wanting to open wide to somebody who's full of agendas that might be manipulative or problematic. So there's a little bit of a gauging of who it is that I'm with, and part of that is by noticing how much they're available to receive me and others. Is that the kind of thing you're suggesting we tune into and feel into?
Yeah, and also the initial need for safety. Like, where does it come from that I need to relax with someone into a deeper meeting? Or why are we, you know, if I need to relax or feel safe, it means that I don't feel safe and I'm not relaxed in the first place. Otherwise, I'm anyway relaxed. How should I relax into something that is anyway relaxed? So it might be that in the first milliseconds of a meeting, many things have already happened when we look at someone. So I see a stranger, I see a taxi driver, I see like the person in the grocery store, and I see the person in the workshop that I'm sitting in 5 minutes. So usually when you look at a workshop or a retreat, there is a certain level of separation in the first minutes, maybe hours. But usually people after 3 days are so intimate that they don't want to go home, or they shared something that they didn't share with their intimate partners. So what's actually the process of intimacy? And to see that I think there are many evolutionary habits that we collected through thousands of years of human evolution that are playing between us in this first moments. And I think if we as a culture will actually look at this more closely and infuse the process with awareness, we will be able to transform it or to include and transcend it. And then it's the question if we still relate to people that we don't know as strangers, or if there's a new version that we are finding out right now. You know, we don't know how it looks like, but maybe we are finding something out. And so
I certainly understand how in a sangha, in a community of practice, where there's some shared understanding about why we're all here, and I'm meeting people and I know that they too are practitioners and that they are interested to to open beyond any limitations and to really engage the deepest possibilities of meeting and being met, then I make a very different assumption, and I'm quite open and I'm very curious, and I'm even willing to see them with golden eyes. Dustin DePerna likes to use that phrase, where you imagine maybe this person is awake in ways that I'm not, you know, and I have an availability to be surprised and freed up and opened in a way I might not have expected. But I think when I'm in a public space where there are all kinds of people walking through, including people who might be not so developed, I am waiting to make sure that I am safe, and there's different levels of safety. Maybe I'm safe that they won't try to kill me, but am I safe that they won't, that they'll be truly available? You know, there's a kind of gauging of that I think we all do, and I am wondering if there's a shifting of our relationship to that we can do before the whole society changes, and
right.
What would that be?
And I think what you're saying is true. So when we practice this in a sangha, it's easier. But when you sign up for a soccer team, you also don't play with tennis rackets. So of course you go to soccer players because they want to play soccer, like you do. So you have actually specifications or groups that specialize in experimenting and developing some human skills. So that's definitely good. But I'm actually interested how a practitioner of awakening in our daily life can practice that, so that I'm actually, it starts with being curious and not taking things for granted. I think awakening has also a lot to do with how is awake spirit, which means spirit that's not clouded by the past, really present with the present moment, or with a certain, you know, with the dynamics of the present moment. And so we are looking at things where we might evolutionarily keep habits that are actually not true anymore for us. They actually prevent the higher intelligence of taking place, or from taking place. And now I think when you walk in the train station or at the airport, or, you know, you sit, you walk on the street, or you meet people in daily life situations, so that's actually where we practice. So I don't practice just in my sangha. I practice actually every moment I meet a human being. And so when I am able to walk into new situations and keep a contemplative state that works in two directions. One is it works into my inner world, and it works into my outer world. So, and I learn to keep this double arrow awareness. So I'm aware that in the first seconds I might maybe contract, or I might feel fear that I don't know that if this person is really like a good person or a dangerous person. So, but the fear that I meet might be a conditioned fear that relates to how I have been programmed to relate. But then it's the fear is usually not really reflecting reality, because often we are afraid of new people, but after 2 days they are our friends. And so the fear in the first place was not really justified. It was not that the person was a dangerous person, now it's a good person because they spend time with me. But usually I feel fears that are actually coming from my past. Or I don't feel relaxed because I see my past on top of the face of the person. And so what I'm suggesting is that we become curious in our life situations, however developed or undeveloped people might be. And I will not be, in a way, run by my past. But for that, I need to illuminate it first, because otherwise I don't even know that I am being run by my past. And so that's, I think, a very lovely practice that all of us can do all the time. Because you talk to the woman behind the counter at the airport, and you sit with a taxi driver and they start talking to you. And so there is actually a lot of a marketplace practice, a moment-to-moment practice in the marketplace possible. But I can illuminate thousands of years of crystallized human past.
Yeah.
Which might have some fears and some contractions and some projections, and I can illuminate them and clear them by the time and not be run by it. And I think that's an exciting possibility to go into as a, you know, group of people that are interested in awakening.
You know, it's it's so often a function when I enter into a situation with a lot of deep safety and connection and humor, and often it shows up as playfulness. I will often reach out in a way that touches people more than they're used to, and I'll break through the usual quality of stiffness that is a quality of common society in a way that presumes connection. And it's almost like I let the person show me that they're too uptight to make contact, if that's the way it is, rather than very slowly coming to that place. I will open it up, and that is often a function really of the richness of the feeling field of my own connection to myself.
Right.
And that when I'm very richly connected to myself, my soul qualities, to source itself out of that, there's this humor and this sense of playfulness and this sense that the relational field is a place where maybe I can bring a kind of love and humor that help illuminate the connections that are already there. And it's almost like there's always this joke that we're all already connected, and I'm sharing that joke with people and seeing who catches on.
Yeah, and you said something beautiful. You said that when you meet somebody and you're playful, so something stiff melts. But I'm questioning, what is this stiffness in the first place? So what does it mean when we say people are uptight, or people are nice on the surface but actually protective more inside?
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I think we can illuminate, but I think we are the ones, whoever does it, is we are the ones where life becomes aware of this habit. And so you mentioned many, you know, how many situations, how it can look like in reality when you meet people. And so now we can also explore the process of what are actually the fears that are arising. And some of them might be personal, some of them might be collective or from our, you know, evolutionary past. But they might run our first moments of meeting people. But the more we are actually separate, separation runs society, and not connection. I feel when I need to protect myself from you, then usually I'm not connected to you. Because I deeply believe that when there's a real danger, we will feel it even more the more we are connected to the situation. But usually we are contracted, but actually there is no reason to be contracted. You know, in the groups, people are afraid to speak in front of 150 people, but actually there is no danger. So what are we afraid of? So there is a fear that runs the moment that doesn't belong into the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the awakening into the process of a stranger and intimacy is a very huge thing for our intelligence. Because how often is the scientist that sits in Australia and the one that sits in the Bay Area, as long as they are strangers, they are not, coming up to their full potential with each other. But once they are friends, they will share data with each other, they will explore things with each other, they will run much more intelligence in the intersubjective space. And so I think that the habit of creating strangers, when it's not connected to violent people and dangerous people and people that really want to hurt us, but when it's connected to a habit, actually slows our intelligence down as a culture. Because then I share less, I'm more suspicious. But then the people that I was suspicious with 1 year ago, they are now my friends. So what was the reason of this initial suspicion?
You're talking about something very exquisitely beautiful here. I'm really appreciating how the number one, just the quality of attention that notices the non-necessity of this habit of whatever we call it, stiffness or disconnection, that it's all superficial, and that we would be safer if we were more open and connected and presuming a kind of tacit intimacy, in a sense, with all of existence, with all living beings, with all human beings, and that we wouldn't be any less safe because in that presumption we could feel the fear or the potential for violence or whatever it might be in someone that we would need to be careful with, you know, to keep ourselves safe.
Right.
And in noticing that, I'm noticing that there's another important distinction. When I spoke about how I can sometimes presume intimacy with people, and there's a kind of humor and playfulness. You know, there are quite a lot of people who have a great deal of interpersonal skill who can do something like this just because they're very extroverted and confident and have strong interpersonal skills, but who are not really available for a real meeting, maybe not to really fully sense and receive the other person in a deep way. They just are not shy, and they can be playful and humorous on the outside. You know, they're more of a sales personality or you know, sometimes we call it. And we're not talking about that. We're really talking about something much more sensitive and receptive, I guess receptivity, like an ability to feel and sense into the field of the other person is key to this.
Right. And you said something beautiful. What we're talking here about has nothing to do with being extroverted or it's not accessible for people that are introverts. I'm talking about it because both of it is actually already, in a way, a defense. So there might be very extroverted people, but they don't allow intimacy to happen. It just creates a lot of connection, like on the superficial level, but there's no real connection. And so that's not what I'm talking about, but I'm talking about besides the way how it looks like, the way how we engage. And you said something beautiful. You said, am I able to attune myself to myself and to the other in any given moment? It doesn't matter how long or how short is the meeting, so that this is a function of my consciousness, that I'm able to perform this as a coherent function. And not only one human being, that the culture will create an ability of performing this. So whenever you meet somebody, there is an awareness and an inclusiveness of the other energy field, and an awareness and inclusiveness of my own internal process. And so then within my own sphere of consciousness, I can hold more and more by practicing this, both at the same time, which means consciousness unifies both. So suddenly the two-ness of people happens in one space of consciousness. And I think that that's an evolutionary progress, and usually evolution needs practice. And so I think that's something where we need to overcome a certain level of collective conditioning, but when enough people practice it, it will become easier and easier to stay attuned and present and become an inclusive space that gives or is inclusive of you and I at the same time. And so my interior space and your interior space is actually in both of our awareness. So I'm aware of this in me and you are aware of this in me and you. And so the space between us is actually less separate. And I don't think that this needs time. That's a state of consciousness. That's not like necessarily a process. But like in the mystical tradition, the less we have conscious awareness, the more we need a process. So the process is there to illuminate the part of life that needs more conscious awareness. So the more intimacy needs time, it means that we need to get to know each other, which means that we need really to open our defenses to meet. So, but once a practitioner of awakening, and I think that's especially important for people who practice within culture, because culture is the first milliseconds and the first moments of our meeting is as much culture as after 1 year that we know each other and we are friends. But I think as a cultural intelligence, so how intelligent we are as a collective depends on the level of separation. So the more we are separate, the less intelligent we are together.
And there's something very provocative here, because of course I know you and we've worked together, and I'm aware of your teachings on transparent communication, which is a lot of what you're evoking here, is a quality of the transparency of our consciousness to ourselves and one another, and a big aspect of that, of course, is the spontaneity, the aliveness of us deepening into the consideration of every moment, or just deepening into every moment, such that what comes out of our mouths is original and new, and we're alive to whatever might be emergent that might even surprise us. And in some past conversations, we've talked about this, about how we can be surprised by the next thing coming out of our own mouths. And it would seem to me that this kind of intimacy with the field itself is not just an intimacy with myself and with you or whoever else I'm with the other people who are listening right now, but it's an intimacy with emergence itself, with life, with what is possible to come into being.
Right, right. And therefore, I think that's the foundation that the emergence between you and I, or us, or we, or the culture, is really enhanced by this. That's the foundation. So I think the relational piece will help me to include my past and to help me to transcend my past, but it's actually there for the future of all of us to show up between us. So, and the more separate you are, it's harder, but I think we all know these conversations where we talk to someone and suddenly we feel, you know, we had this more often in the past that we talked and suddenly there was such a lovely flow, emergence of new things, it was original, it was creative, and then when we both left, we felt inspired. So I think that's something that many people also know at certain times, and I think that's an option for all of us that can happen more and more. But it's usually limited by the separation in consciousness. So the more we feel separate, the less, you know, we get into this flow state with each other.
And the just feeling into the field of the people who are with us now, I know I've gotten a lot of questions over the course of the 8-session course that I taught to the folks who are listening in. There were many questions about, well, what happens when I lose it, when I feel disconnected, when I lose my sense of inspiration and possibility? And in a way, the question is a question about crossing over from that place of being a stranger to ourselves to having that fundamental quality of intimacy with the livingness of ourselves, our soul, you know, the moment, and therefore each other, and what is emerging. And so I'm remembering that I've gotten those questions many times, and I'm interested to invite you to speak to that. So from that place of being shut down, that's a different consciousness. What is it that someone remembers in that moment that's helpful to them?
First of all, that whenever we feel disconnected or we feel we lost it, the most important thing is not to fight it. I think many people get even more stuck by thinking losing it is not okay. And what I'm saying, losing it is as good as having it. And so, because in the moment that losing it is part of a possibility, try and error is part of the possibility of life learning something, so I will relax into the situation that suddenly I feel separate from you. I feel separate from a certain situation. I feel like I am not connected anymore. But not being not connected is part of our life. And if I judge it as bad, usually I contract even more.
Right.
And then I have no chance. It's like someone that get caught in a spider web. Like, once you are in a spider web, the more you fight it, the more you entangle yourself in it. And I think that happens for many people in daily life situation, that it seems, oh, being connected is the good thing and being disconnected or contracted is the bad thing, so better not to have the bad thing. But that's usually where, like, we run into deep trouble. Because sometimes, sometimes people have a meditative experience and an opening, and then it disappears, they think it's bad. And then they fight it, and then, but all the moments that I fight it, I'm not present to life, for life. So in the moment I really feel disconnected, the first thing is to say, yes, this is exactly what it is, this is exactly where I am, and this is where I practice love. You know, saying yes to the disconnected moment is loving the disconnected moment. And so many people talk about unconditional love, but it stops there where we think something is wrong. And so in the moment I say, yes, I feel disconnected, and all I have at the moment is to drop into it. And once I have a yes, I will also open my eyes again to look at the situation. And then I will feel that most of the time when I feel disconnected, it's just when I avoid in myself a certain quality that comes up according to the given situation. Which means somebody talks to me, I don't like what he or she says, it makes me angry, I feel afraid, I feel sad, and I shut down my anger, my fear, my sadness, whatever, my sexual impulse, my attraction, my whatever. And so every time I shut down a sensation in myself, I need to contract. And usually when I contract away from shame, fear, anger, sexual attraction in myself, I suddenly feel separate from the other person. Because I build a separation in me. It's not that we are separate from the world, it's we are separate from something in us. And because I create a wall in my own energy, I suddenly feel this also with you. Then it looks like it's a wall between us. But usually the wall is just sensations or unexperienced sensations. So I think the first step to this question would be, can you find a yes? The second step, the yes helps you to open your eyes. And with open eyes, you look for what's the sensation that you're avoiding right now. And usually in the moment we reconnect to, oh, actually I got angry now. But I didn't allow myself to feel angry, so I shut it down. And when I reconnect to the anger, my energy opens, and usually then the separation melts. And a different thing it is when we run into traumatized places, of course, there it's a bit more complex because there's frozen life energy that we need to work with more professionally. But usually, all comes down to the same principle, I believe.
Beautiful. Well, we've begun a process here that I want to invite those who are on the line to participate in, and I see that we've already got one question that was typed in by someone who's listening on the computer. If you're listening to us through the Instant Teleseminar computer link, you can type in a question. And if you're listening by the phone, by Maestro, you can raise your hand by pressing 1 on your keypad. And we have a question from Dana in Chicago who asked, when you become aware that you're being run by the past when encountering or interacting with someone, should you communicate to them, or just notice it and try to be more present rather than reactive?
Yeah, basically, in the moment you become aware that you're run by the past, it means that you're buying into certain sensations or feelings that are not connected to the moment. So, for example, somebody walks somewhere, suddenly you have an existential fear. And then another person talks to you, but you already contracted, and then you need to make a decision, and you make it out of fear, not out of feeling connected to yourself. So in this moment, it's what we say, being run by the past, means that you watch a movie in the cinema, and you have an advertisement on top of your main movie. So you will not see your main movie clearly. And so as long as you can be aware of the process and reconnect to yourself, it's great. If you cannot do that, then of course it's necessary to communicate this with the outside world or find a way how to deal with the moment if it's not possible to communicate this to the outside world. So then maybe a decision, if it's possible, needs to be postponed, or until you again reconnect to what you feel. So in order to make decisions, we need a compass and we need a direction. But if I don't feel my direction, I will maybe make a decision that I regret later on, because it didn't come out of my potential, it came out of my past.
Yeah.
And so I think the to give each ourselves the time, even if you talk to someone and suddenly you feel you disconnected for a moment, and you just hold, like you just stay quiet for 1 or 2 seconds, you reconnect, and then you continue. So it has a lot to do with the love that you give yourself, the space for what you need in order to run your life, you know, sustainably and properly. And so many people think, if I just pause now, then what will the person think of me? So I need to produce something in order for them to stay with me. But when you are present enough, people will anyway stay, because it's not the content usually, but the presence that magnetizes contact. And so I think there are small practices that we can do in our daily life that we give ourselves a chance to reconnect and to, you know, sometimes it's good to slow down or have a moment to breathe and then continue with whatever is going on right now. So there are many practices that we can do, but if there is a possibility to share it, because this helps me to reconnect, so that's definitely one of the practices, yes.
You know, it strikes me that it's important to use discernment and to not relate to any moment of practice, and this is a point I made a lot during the course, as if there were any formula. So in a moment when you're with someone and you begin to realize you're being run by the past, it could be very skillful to confess that, and maybe that creates an opening where real intimacy can take place, and you confess that you're being run by the past in some way. Maybe the other person is going to notice that too, and it opens up some real free space of relating. In another situation, it might not be very skillful at all to be talking about it. And so you're never able to relate to these principles as if they're just a simple technique or a formula. That
right.
Present moment sensitivity is always key.
Beautiful. Yes, that's very beautiful.
Yeah, and I'm struck by another thing, which is the extension of the beautiful things that you had to say about how that. Accepting that, saying yes to the moment of disconnection, is so key to not just intensifying disconnection and reifying it and making it really stuck, which is often what we do when we say it's not okay that that's happening. Well, it's the same if you notice you're being run by the past. There's something to be learned. This is how life is learning how not to be run by the past, by being run and noticing it. And so that moment of awareness is not a moment of being run by the past in the same way. It's a moment in which there's awareness there too, and not just being run. So even that is something that it's important to appreciate, I think, in order to begin to allow things to move. Would you agree?
Yeah, fully. I think it's very beautiful what you said. And, you know, sometimes it's good to look at this through images. So imagine. There is a filmmaker, and he has a beautiful, very expensive camera to shoot a movie. And then you have this sticker that is on top of the camera. So when you shoot a whole movie through the camera with a sticker, so there is the whole movie, you see the same image, and you think it's part of the movie. And awakening is always... that we wake up from some structures in our reality, that we suddenly see, no, that's not part of the movie, that's on my camera. And therefore it looks like it's part of the movie. But suddenly you are aware of the sticker, and it's not an inherent part of the process. And so once you become aware, there's already a bit of a space between what you say, you or I, and the structure. So we wake up basically from structures of consciousness, and we can include them. There's still a sticker there, but I see it's not just me, which means I start seeing reality more fully because it's not filtered by this sticker. And therefore, this love aspect is so important, because in the moment I start contracting against it, I cannot wake up from it. But in the moment I allow it to appear in my awareness, then I'm including it, transcending it. So what was the camera and the given film is now, wow, a camera, a sticker, and a possibility of a film. But the film can also look differently, because I can take the sticker off and either put another one or do it without sticker. So which will change the movie. And I think that's a very beautiful analogy of how we look through our perception, but our perception is filtered by so many things that we think that's life. But that's not what life is, that's only how life looks like for me. Once my sensory input from inside and outside, so everything I see, I feel, I hear, whatever, is in this moment being filtered by many things. So when I say, okay, what I see is the world and myself, it's not true. What I see and what I feel right now is the world, how it appears through the possibility of my perception. But that's not what is out there, and it's also not only what is in there. And by becoming aware of how the past, for example, filters my, or my conditioned thinking, or my conditioned feeling, or my emotional patterns, my social patterns, they are all filters of my perception. So there's humility, there is love, because we know that we are all sitting in the same boat as human beings, and there is a constant exploration of these filters. And so I become more and more aware of stickers in my own, on my own camera, if the, when the camera is my perception system.
And using that analogy, I notice that I'm kind of correcting for something, because it seems like the way the stickers operate, some of those stickers are themselves moving images, like the advertisement that might be obscuring the movie in your earlier metaphor. That the pattern, it creates a coloring, it creates a mood, or it creates a limitation, and that there's something about that that's fixed, like a sticker, but the way that it shows up is often deceptively morphing in every moment and seeming to show up in a different expression, even though the way it limits vision has a fixed quality like a sticker.
Right. Yeah, it shows up, for example, as an existential fear. Every time I meet another human being, I feel a subtle contraction. I feel a subtle fear. Or every time I meet an authority, I feel insecure. So that's definitely a sticker. Even if the feeling isn't a live feeling, it's something that recurrently shows up in my awareness again and again. Or every time I want to walk up to a woman because I feel attracted to her, and then I feel all this fear come up, or to a man, whoever, however. So that's an advertisement on top of the main movie. So the main movie is I feel an attraction and I want to explore it. And the advertisement is fear, 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 and everything that could go wrong, rejection and this and this and this. So it comes up as alive feelings and thoughts, but it's energy from the past. It's unresolved energy from the past. And so once I know this and I watch out for it, I have a possibility to transform it. And that's what we are pointing out, I think, with all our work here, is that there are possibilities to not stay stuck and limited in this. You know, we have consciousness technologies or practices through thousands of years, human beings have developed them, that can help us to not stay within this framework of our incarnation. And that's, I think, the most exciting part of it.
And it does seem that in both a positive and a negative sense, or at least maybe being pushed as well as being pulled might be a better way to put it, we're in a moment right now where a lot is opening up in terms of our possibilities for intimacy, both because there is a crisis on the planet and we clearly need to be changing, and everyone can feel that. And so that brings a kind of urgency forward, because it's game time. It's time to really be who it is we're here to be. But in a very positive sense, we are daring to be vulnerable in ways we never have before. We're exposed to one another in ways we have never been before. The pouring out of every possible positive, wise, and crazy perspective and so many things posted on the internet, it's like all the points of view are exhausting themselves right now. Everything is on display with pornography everywhere. It's as if everyone has seen each other without their clothes in all the most compromising positions. Everything, there's no secrets. And so there's something of just meeting in a genuine way that is feeling possible and necessary, and the formality or hiding behind a kind of face that might have been part of the formality of culture in some generations past is letting go. And in the meantime, all the spiritual teachings and wisdom and possibility that are circulating in the community that we're in conversation with now are all available, and everyone's learning from each other's confessions of what they've opened up to in the path that they've walked. And so there's a quality of excitement about the possibility for real intimacy with spirit, with the living moment and with each other, that is also opening up like a new flower. There's like dew on the petals. It's very tender and alive. And for both of those things to be happening at once quickens this moment in a way that, of course, it deepens us into something that has been around anciently, but I think there's something about this moment on the planet that is actually genuinely new.
And what is it's called internet. I think what, yeah, but
even
is,
more
is,
than the internet, don't you think there's something even in the intimacies that's arriving that has some newness to it?
Yeah, but I will come in a second to this. I will just go for something first, because many things that you say that are appearing in this relational cultural space where they are so exposed, they are exposed through the internet, many of them. So there's a new level of relating that has a very beautiful side, and it has also a pathology already. Because the pathology, the beautiful side of the internet is that it creates an evolutionary pressure onto human beings to birth kind of a global, world-centric worldview. And not only worldview, but also self. Like that this is really the self that I care for. But the other thing is that within the internet, there is the anonymous part of the exposure is actually often without relation. So it's easier to put something out there, but not to be engaged personally. So there's also a hiding that's happening behind Facebook, and it looks very social, but we really need to see if it's that social at all.
Yeah.
But what I think what we are pressured into is to enlarge the radius of what we can hold as intimate. So if there is a possibility to use the internet and it's totally disconnected, it shows a lot of information, but actually it doesn't show anything because it doesn't touch the vulnerable parts of human beings. Because usually where we connect is through the vulnerability, through the open 10%, through there where we really find out something together, not there where we know it already. You know, we are usually connecting where we are finding out something. And so the internet is an amazing place where we can find out something and enlarge our sense of sensitivity and radius of awareness to a global community. But on the other hand, we will need to overcome this kind of strange, anonymous hiding that is also happening there. And then we will use technology with consciousness. Then the internet is really a stretch for our conscious awareness to hold a large informational field within my awareness. So it becomes really a self and not just an intellectual property. And so that's, I think, an amazing possibility. And this feeds back, I think, this collective possibility that is unique to our time, because this hasn't been here before, is actually having an effect also onto our intimate relationships. So this changes already the context of our intimate relationships. And therefore, they will also change in quality. And as I often say, I think that the great part of it is that we are finding out through all our challenges and beautiful moments that we have with each other, we are finding out how it works. So that's, I think, the most exciting part of it, that life finds out through us how postmodern intimate relationship within a global container is working, that so many people travel a lot, they have a lot of friends all over the world. So there is an international community in different professions and walks of life. We have international communities. And also the learning curve of human consciousness is being increased dramatically, I believe. You know, last time I said the skateboard, that the boy that is practicing with his skateboard in the backyard had five friends before. Now you have 500,000 friends that do the same skateboard trick on video. They film each other and they put it onto some platforms. But you actually exchange a lot of knowledge. You learn a lot from a much bigger community. So this again feeds back to the way we understand personal or, you know, one-on-one intimacy. So I think that's like a process in progress, but it's an important exploration, you know, that the intimate relationship is changing within the context that is enlarging itself.
It's interesting because there's so much conversation going on right now. Some important new books have been published even about how, in some ways, our wired culture makes us less intimate, and how we create this fake version of ourselves that's always having a great time and living a great life and having photos of smiles and beautiful places on our Facebook page. But then when you talk to the person in a more intimate way, well, they had all kinds of maybe more difficult feelings that they weren't even willing to share on Facebook because they were busy putting up this false persona there. And then also that maybe the kids get so used to texting each other that when they get together in person, they sit in the room together and everybody's on their mobile phones and they don't even talk, but they text each other even though they're right there in the room together. And yet we're also seeing that there is this positive potential. And I think maybe it's the self-awareness that notices our tendencies to falsify ourselves combined with the awareness that is willing to show up and to have that deeper intimacy with ourselves and therefore availability with one another, that are, it's the play of all that churning that you're talking about, and how that is perhaps for those of us who are healthiest, who are able to make use of this, who aren't sinking and being dragged down by the pattern, but who are able to make conscious use of the pattern, it's creating the space for a much richer self-awareness and therefore a much richer we.
Right. And this richness of the we is actually dependent on all of our curiosities. Because I think we can really find out amazing ways how to write emails, you know, that really to connect in the subtle field to the person that we write to, or we can just write it. You know, you can talk to someone on your mobile phone and be fully intimate energetically, or you just, you know, it's a mechanic act. So and other ways that we are going to find out that we don't even talk about today, you know, because we don't know them. They are just showing up through exploration. But I think the awake community is only awake because it keeps the curiosity to find out new things and to illuminate old things. And the more we, all of us, participate in this process, we are actually increasing human intimacy. And the increase of human intimacy, I think, is a very important answer, because that's the foundation of intelligence. You know, I think when from cells to organisms, there is a jump in the increase of relation. So when different cells that our bodies are able to perform this talk right now, the coherence in the intelligence of the cells of my body producing these words is actually a miracle. You know, that every cell knows what to do, and they are relating and they're volunteering to do it, is actually an amazing achievement. And that's also true for us as a culture. So the more we will be able to increase the relational capacity, the intersubjectivity, and to fill the intersubjectivity with awareness, I believe something new is emerging through us, something that we didn't know, something that we are finding out. And I think we are living in a time, and I believe that the internet is a big pressure for this, that we are finding out something new right now in this birth of a global culture. And the global culture, again, feeds back to every personal experience because the context is bigger. Personal is not any more personal was it what it was 500 years ago. So I think the curiosity that we have as practitioners and that we are really, or what I often say, mystics of our time are the ones that are using 24 hours a day to find out what life is. And so that's our calling. But we are definitely finding out something once we are looking for it. And I think we have to, one contract with the divine is to find out something, to become an answer for something.
It's beautiful what you said about how our intimacy is actually our intelligence, that it's that there's a greater there's a greater intelligence that arises out of us opening into the space of our connectedness to one another. And
right.
I've experienced this, but I don't think I've heard it said quite directly in that way, Thomas. I'm really appreciating and resonating with that.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
We have Linda Marshall has raised her hand, so I'm going to call on you, Linda. Welcome. You're on the line with us.
Okay, well, some of what I heard you talking about earlier reminded me of just a snippet of a piece that I got on NPR today. They were talking about working with executives on emotional intelligence, and the executives were surprised to find that their scores were low in that area. So they gave them a challenge because they said that our brain is programmed to listen for rejection. And they challenged them to go through a period of time, I forget how long it was, I think the next week, listening for connection. And that was the end. You know, then I was in the car and I had to do something else, so I didn't hear the rest of the interview. But when Thomas was talking about the things that we carry from our evolutionary past, it reminded me of that because that would be one of the things that our brain is programmed to listen for rejection. Just thought that was interesting.
Right, that's pretty much part of, yeah, that's one aspect of it that we talked about before, that how the wiring of the past actually influences our moments, but in milliseconds. This happens so fast that we often just see the consequence of it, not the process itself. And I think if we can see how our brain is also wired to expect rejection, and that I'm becoming aware of the process, because as I said, as long as I don't see the sticker on the camera, I think it's part of it. That's normal. That's how life is. When I wake up from something, I see, no, hey, wait a minute, that's not normal. The film doesn't look like this. The camera has a sticker that looks like this. So I see that actually human perception is wired, and it's good. It's a good thing, I think, that we are all wired by thousands of years of evolution. This is also what we want, but we don't want to be stuck in it. We don't want to be limited by it. And so that's a beautiful thing that you said. That's definitely one part. How can I become aware of my expectation to be rejected? And not just the symptom of it, but the moment where it starts. Some people say, okay, and then suddenly I feel this contraction in the heart.
Yeah.
And where did this contraction in the heart start? And who is responsible for it? Who has the remote control for your heart to shut down your heart? So that we see the symptoms, and then we feel, oh, I feel disconnected. But did we also feel the decision to disconnect? So when I'm aware of the beginning of the process, I start mastering it. if I'm aware of the effect of the process, I am it. It runs me. And so that's what I'm saying, that this, the piece that you are bringing is beautiful, because that's definitely for many people true, that we go in, we meet a stranger, but we are already afraid of rejection, of being hurt, of being whatever. Yeah.
They weren't
and
talking
it's our
so
journey
much
to transform it. Go ahead.
Yeah. They weren't talking so much about the expectation of personal rejection, but that we listen to another person's opinions to reject them, to find how we're different instead of how we're common, where the common ground is. So we're rejecting what other people, their perspective, presenting to us.
Right.
That's the way they were talking about it.
Right, but that's the same thing, just reversed, I believe.
Right,
that's
right.
That's the same thing. We just turn it to the other side and turn it around.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Linda. And if there's anyone else who would like to ask a question, is there anything more though, Linda? Does this? You were talking about something that you heard on the radio. If you'd like to continue the dialogue about this, particularly if there's a level of it that is registering for you as a living question in your own life and inquiry, I don't mean to cut you off from going there.
No, you can move on.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank
yes,
you.
But I initially also understood it that we are expecting rejection, and that this is what you're talking about. But I think it's interesting to explore the same thing in the other direction. You know, that we reject what other people say, and we don't let it fully in. So I think the basic principle of the exploration works on all these subjects.
It's interesting, though. It's a very different move to reject others. I feel a little harder. Like if I'm wondering if I'm being rejected, there's a part of me that's reaching out to connect and not being feeling strong. If I'm wondering about rejecting the other, I'm feeling more strong in myself, and in a way a little bit hardened. And it's as if I don't have as much hope for connection when I'm in that stance.
Right, right. Now, I think there's definitely a difference also in these both dynamics. It's not the same.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, in both cases, there's a question about connection. And I think what you're saying has to do with realizing that connection's never in question, that it's always here. It's just how aware are we of it and how fully are we alive and participating in it.
Right, so what we could say is that connection is above content. So one of the principles would be that relation is higher than content.
Yeah, or if we looked at it from another perspective, we could say it's even more fundamental, or it's unthreatenable, and
right,
and yeah. It's deeper too.
Both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful, because it's out of seeking. When you seek to create connection, you have to already distrust that it's there, because then it needs to be created, and there's a weakness in that, and therefore you're subject to rejection in a different way. So this unravels that whole dynamic and lets us just open our awareness into what is.
Right.
Where we are connected already. Yeah.
Right, right. And so the disagreement upon content is something that happens within a relational field. And so we can have frictions or creative dialogues or even creative criticism, and it's happening within an open relational field. Or I can shut down and separate myself from you and then criticize you, or have an opinion about you, or see things differently. But these are two very different modes of being in life, or life, because as long as I can keep the relational space open, this doesn't mean that I agree with the content, that I agree with you, that I agree with a pattern, that I agree with a collective pattern. That's not true. I can be open to the collective dynamics, but I don't have to participate with the content. But still, the relation is more foundational. It's more fundamental, as you say. And the practice, I think our practice is how to keep the relational space open, but be also critical and sharp and you know, have a sword where it's needed. It's not that relation has a face, like love, relation, clarity, presence. They don't have a face. But they will, you know, the face of it is emerging as we are experiencing it the moment, which means that I can be totally open to you, but I totally am very clear that I will not support this, what you want to say or want to do in your life.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. Well, Thomas, I'd like to invite Mark Hetzinger onto the line. He's raised his hand.
Hello.
Welcome, hello. Mark. Hello.
Hi. So I don't know if I have a question. I just think this is a great opportunity to explore a relational space with both Thomas and you. And so I'd like to start out by sharing that I'm a little nervous and scared and would like to, I completely believe in sort of the relational field as a way to point out your blocks and your contractions, right? And so I just think it's an opportunity to, you know, share that with you, Thomas, and explore deepening a connection in the, you know, the next couple minutes. So that's what's going on there, and I was just wondering how you would react to what I said. Hello?
Yeah, that's definitely possible, and I don't, you know, we can, as you offer it, it's a relation in silence.
Right, and when I hear that, I deepen immediately, and I go below the fear, right, and then that's clearing up pretty quickly. That's good, thank you. So that opens up the next question, which is, I'm really more interested in hearing about the particular pathologies of the internet. I've read a couple of books by this programmer guy in Southern California who's kind of an internet sort of critic, and how some of the language of programming is actually creating distortions in the culture and how people are supposed to behave and really encouraging this connection. And so I don't know if you have any further to offer about that than what you've already said, but it feels to me like there might be some real sort of fruitful explorations and sort of using almost voice dialogue to voice these sort of cultural kinks so that people can become aware of them and not be completely run by them. And so I don't know if you have any particular extra content or insight around that, but that's kind of what I am starting to explore in my own work.
Right. And I'm sure that that there are pathologies to the development of the internet, but that's usually not the first thing that I look at. The first thing that I look at is, okay, what is the evolutionary progress add-on and the creative impulse in its development? Because nothing in itself is just good or bad. And
right.
Nothing, once something appears in life, it has a reason and it has a meaning. And so I want to first taste the full, you know, flowering of the internet. And I say this often in the wisdom traditions, I think one aspect of wisdom is that we see emergences. We see that a certain intelligence brings forth certain innovations. And then that the wisdom is actually that we see, and maybe this is what, I don't know what's written in this book, but maybe this is one aspect that the book points out, is that the wisdom always looks what are the pathologies that we need to correct and become aware of as new evolutionary impulses. So that actually even the parts that seem like they are going wrong are part of an evolutionary process. So the beauty of being inclusive of the, let's say, positive sides and the difficult sides of any development, like capitalism or nuclear power or whatever we have, there are many, or globalization. And so, but to rest in the space in between good or bad, or in between light and dark, positive and negative, and from there to create a field of awareness around both. And so I think that's a beautiful exploration, and then I'm sure that any kind of programming, any kind of lines of information that are flowing through a human being, every neuron that connects to another neuron in my brain already crystallizes a possibility.
Uh-huh.
And so we have to crystallize possibilities as human beings, because that's who we are. We are also structure. But the question is, how much are we limited to that possibility, or how much do we create structures that are dynamic and movable? So I'm interested how much we actually get stuck in all the wirings of the internet in the collective consciousness, or how much can we stay dynamic with the wiring? We see it's necessary, and it needs to stay an open, dynamic, creative process. And so I think there are always course corrections on the way, so it's definitely a very interesting exploration.
Yeah, cool. Thanks. Yeah, and then when I hear you talk, I just come right back to that sort of superpower of being just aware moment by moment what you're feeling when you're exploring any context, right? So what's coming up and what patterns are sort of behind the scenes and relating to them. So, and that's, of course, true with the internet. And it was just great to hear you, how you speak to the positive sides of these patterns, how they actually are sort of this karmic driver as well as, you know, yes, there's pathology as well, and that was really cool. So thank you.
Right. Thank you so much. Very interesting.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark. Well, Thomas, we're getting close to the end of the time we wanted to spend together, but I'm feeling like after having wandered into these different areas, it might be really useful to maybe offer some kind of concluding remarks, because we've touched on a lot of really beautiful material in this time we've spent, and I think maybe there might be a way to take some of the territory we've just been wandering into and bringing it back to the themes that we began with.
Right. Yeah, first of all, I think a conclusion of this talk, which means like basically a conclusion for life, I believe, is how much can we support in ourselves or in others the spirit unfolding. And spirit unfolding means that how much can we support this mutual exploration of life and seeing that however difficult or easy our lives are, we are in it for a reason. And we are in it to explore the easy or the difficult. And I think to the motivation and the excitement that comes from this, that we are actually in an amazing journey. Like we are in life that is on a journey. But we are in it right now. And I think that journey depends on us. And so many people might feel sometimes weighed down by everything that's happening in the world and how wherever we go there are so many threats of nuclear and the ecological and technological threats. But actually within this there is a thriving human intelligence and eros that is moving forward, And I think to connect to the to this positive creative impulse that is in it is so key that we will really develop the insights, the inventions, and the social structures that will help us to solve these critical questions that we are in. And so we are all every day asked when we get up if we are being weighed down, or if we, you know, are willing to feel the whole range of what it means to be a human being and to allow the complexity, but to stay connected to that which creates us. And I think then our life runs in a very different on a very different track. So this would be one conclusion, I believe.
That's beautiful. And it actually strikes me, you know, something I've begun to talk about a little bit more is the soul and the this connection to that which creates us. In a way, that which creates us ultimately is, you know, the universal, it's the onlyness, the divine itself, and yet it finds its way into form in a personal way. And that beautiful comment about being connected to that which creates us is also about trusting the very personal way that our own soul quality is creating our own trajectory of awakening and service and action in life. So, yeah, it touches me. Thank you so much for being how you are and who you are, Thomas. It's always a delight to have these conversations, these public conversations that we've had now many times. And I feel always the delicacy of the way that you place your attention is an invitation to everyone to notice the aliveness and the already connectedness that we're always in. So I think I've been served, and I trust that everyone has been.
Yes, and I thank you, Terry, because I really appreciate your continuous invitations to different parts of your work, and it's and I really enjoy our mutual exploration since years, and it's beautiful. And there was also one thing that I like to the one thing that came to me to the question of Linda when she said that with the rejection of different other opinions. So when I said that the inside rejection and the outside rejection are basically the same, so I will look into this deeper if this is really true. But I think I want to explore this more. I said this very quickly, but I want to explore this more. How we Where is the meeting of expecting rejection and rejecting the outside? And I think I take this also from the call as an impulse to explore something deeper, because I think that's something that happens often in our culture. And I answered quite quickly, but I want to explore this deeper if this is really true. So something that I want to add that kept being open for me.
Well, beautiful. Thank you so much, Thomas. The conversation never ends, but this particular free bonus teleseminar is now complete.